Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Adam Davis. Session number is 98-1, and it's titled, What's Happened to the Promised Land? Let's listen in.
My name's Adam Davis, and I'm up here till August 1st, and I serve the village as the junior miners and miners leader. And the reason I'm going to give this talk is I traveled for 5 months through the Middle East last fall through St. Olaf College in Minnesota, studying political science, sociology, among other things. And for the last month and a half of that trip, well, first we started a month each in Turkey, in Istanbul, then a month in Morocco, then a month in Cairo, and then a week or so in Jordan, and then a month in the occupied territories in Israel. So where should we start? I guess what I should say first is I was talking to Mary and Jim, and I was remembering a movie. I don't know if any of you are from Minnesota, but a movie called Grumpy Old Men. And there's a scene in that movie where the two characters, Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, right? They're each other's nemesis. And Anne Margaret is courting Jack Lemmon, and she's looking through all of his pictures. And she sees a picture of when Jack Lemmon was a child, and a picture of Walter Matthau when they were both children. And she says, so that's the old Fink. And he says, yep. And they're holding fishes that they had caught. And she said, what happened? You guys used to be such good friends. And I said, yeah, well, he stole her from me. And it turns out Walter Matthau had stolen a girl of his, Jack Lemmon's, fancy when they were young kids. And from then on, they were hated rivals. And it just kind of reminded me of the Israeli-Palestinian debate. They're a bunch of grumpy old men arguing about land. But it's a little more tragic than that and a little more deep than that. But I thought that was a good starting off point. Has anybody been to the Middle East or Israel ever? Okay, good. So I want to preface my remarks by saying I'm not an expert. So, and I think Mary and Jim were saying I left more confused than I came, but I know more. So if that helps, that's how it feels. I guess we should start with what happened before 1948, which is when Israel gained its independence, as it says. The Zionist movement started in the late 20th century with Theodor Herzl, who was a journalist in Switzerland. And he watched the Dreyfus Affair, which was an army officer who was Jewish, was probably falsely accused of treason. And while he was walking out, Herzl was covering this, and he heard people screaming for blood of the Jew, to kill the Jew. And at that moment, Herzl decided that the only way the Jewish population, the culture, was going to be kept safe is if they had a national homeland of their own, because they had been in the diaspora for 2,000 years. He started the Zionist movement, which was an attempt to get all the Jews in the world back into one nation, and the first option was Palestine. But that wasn't the only option. They had ideas in Uganda, Rwanda, South America, but Palestine was always the first option. So what happened is they started buying back land. They organized themselves, the Jews organized themselves, and started buying back land from the absentee landlords, Arab landlords, in Palestine. A common misconception is that there is that before the Jews came back to Palestine, that there was no population in Palestine. That's very much false, and that's something that I think Americans don't understand, is that there are about 800,000 Arabs living, or Palestinians living, in the land before when they started coming back around 1920. And so that happens, and this tension started to arise.
How many Jews were there?
Very little, actually. They started coming back. up until 1948, but, or in 48 was when they got their independence, but actually there were very few. There were some who had lived, there was a population of Jews that had lived in Palestine during the diaspora. Most had been scattered across the world, so there are very few actually. And even in 1948, when the war broke out, there actually was an outnumbered, Jews were outnumbered very heavily. So anyways, the UN partition in 1947 happened, and Harry Truman, another misconception, was not in favor of the partition of land. He thought it was a mistake. The British had taken over, had done a mandate on Palestine after they had conquered the Ottoman Empire, which had previously controlled the area. The British had had enough of that. They weren't going to stay around for this civil war, and they had made a mess of it already enough by allowing Jews to come back and not really settling it or keeping people at bay, and turned over the UN, and the UN partitioned the land into a state of Israel and a state of Palestine. Arabs did not accept that that agreement, and a war broke out between Transjordan, Syria, Egypt, and most every Arab country there, plus Palestinians who were still living in the area. And Israel won. And Harry Truman, when he decided to announce his support for the partition, said, after he had come under enormous pressure from American Jews, said one of his most cynical lines, he said, well, I guess there just aren't a lot of Arab voters in America. And that's pretty much how he decided to support the creation of the State of Israel. They won the 48 war, and since then, the Arabs have been, quote, trying to push the Jews into the sea, which is their favorite rabble-rousing term. It never seems to work. And 48, 56, 67 was when they conquered the occupied territories and then got the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I'll get back to that later. And then in 73, and then the Intifada, which broke out internally in the occupied territories. I don't know where we should, that's a brief history, that's not enough, but yeah.
Could you go back to the role the British played at that time period?
Yeah.
In 1948, it seems to me that there was a Jewish underground that was sabotaging the British for a while.
Yeah, that was the Haganah. And what happened is that Jews had started coming back into the area, and it was under a British mandate. They had conquered the Ottoman Empire in World War I. And between Britain and France, they had divided up the Middle East in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And Winston Churchill said the line, I've just created four countries in it. With the stroke of my hand, he'd drawn some lines on the Middle East map and created Transjordan, Palestine, and some other Syria. The Balfour Declaration is kind of the key moment. In November of 1917, I have that at the bottom of my terms. That stated that Her Majesty's government views with favor the creation of a state of a Jewish state in the area of Palestine. And the Israeli government loves to quote that because it kind of gives them legitimacy, although that's kind of colonialism if you think about it. I mean, they're creating a nation in a non-Western, a Western power is creating a nation in a non-Western area. They love to quote that part. What they don't like to quote is the second line, which says, as long as it does not interfere or intrude on the native population that already exists. So the Palestinians love to quote that line without really ever quoting the first line. Different reasons, of course. So Balfour declared that for the British. And then 48, General Allenby, who was the governor of the mandate, pulled out, or 1947, excuse me, pulled out and left it for a civil war to decide what was going to happen. The UN had partitioned it. Whether Israel was going to be able to survive was another question, and they were able to. The Haganah was trying to undermine the British mandate, as were the Palestinians. Nobody wanted the British there. Nobody wants a colonial power in their land. Which leads me to Deir Yassin, which is right in the middle of my terms. That happened in April of 48. Little tiny town, village of Palestinians. led by a group of they're called the Irgun, which was a Jewish-Israeli terrorist organization, led by Menachem Begin, who became the prime minister of Israel, went in there and sent a message to the Palestinian people that they had better leave by killing and massacring the entire village. About 258 people were massacred, women, children, and men. And so when the Israelis say, well, it's not our fault that the Palestinians, or they don't even say Palestinians, that the Arabs left, they left on their own will. Well, maybe that's not as entirely the truth. They were told in pretty clear terms to leave, or another day has seen what happened. The Israeli government has yet to backtrack on that. They still believe that that was a all-right conflict and an all-right incident that had happened. It was a peaceful village. It was not a political or military stand, strategic point. It was just a village on the outskirts. I'll get into the, are there any other questions? I'm not a professor or an expert, so I don't know if I'm leaving things out. I'll get into what's happening today, and nothing in the Middle East is clear cut. There's layers upon layers of conflict. And I put the conflicts on the board. Israeli Jews are by no means united, and Palestinians are very much, you know, in disarray. What's going on right now in Israel is Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the prime minister right now, is in severe gridlock. Who knows, political analysts say, who knows what Netanyahu wants? Nobody's really sure, because he is so pulled by the coalition government system, which means that you grab parties from wherever you can to gain your power. He's so pulled by the right wing Jews and the religious Jews that's maybe one reason why he's not too enthusiastic about doing final status talks, which is supposed to be the final measure of the Oslo Accords, which is broken down.
It seems like not only has he been pulled that way, but a lot of his vocabulary has been antagonistic mm-hmm. to peace.
Which
it's like throwing gasoline on the fire. Mm-hmm.
He used that terminology either because he believes it, or because he knows that if he doesn't use that terminology and he doesn't do those actions, his coalition is going to fall apart and he'll be out of power. So most people are pretty sure that he doesn't like the Palestinians much. No Israeli really does. But who knows how far he'd go if he wasn't in such a precarious position. I think right now he has a one-vote majority in the Knesset, which is like the Congress. So if he loses one more vote, he's
kind of... It might be that he doesn't feel that he can give up any more territory or much more, or Israel's going to lose anyway. So I can't see what the man can do.
Yeah,
The difficulty I see, though, is by using the sort of language he has, it's sending a message to the people I would call the crazies over there who are staking, Jews or zealots who are staking out new territory, kicking out Palestinians, I mean, you know, which I think is outrageous. And clearly they are reading his language to say it's okay to do this.
Mm-hmm. What he's talking about is in the occupied territories, which were taken over in 1967, the West Bank. Does anybody here know why it's called the West Bank?
Sure.
It was, the West Bank of Jordan. And the Gaza Strip was occupied by Egypt prior to 1967. Israelis like to point out that at no time when those territories were occupied by other Arabs were they allowed to create their own state or their own government. General Nasser, who was the leader of Egypt, never allowed Palestinians living in Gaza Egyptian citizenship, nor would he allow them to create their own citizenship. Israelis love to point that out. Same with the West Bank. Although a little less so, Jordan does allow Palestinians to become Jordanian citizens, as well as keeping some kind of Palestinian citizenship. But in 1967, when that was all taken over, they have now, what's going on are these Jewish settlements, which I listed, I think, Jewish settlements is what the Israelis call them. Colonies is what the Palestinians call them. What they do is they, if I could draw a map of Israel, or the West Bank, it's something on the line of this. And there's two mountain ranges, and in the middle is a valley. And what they do is the Israeli government goes in at night with helicopters and drops down mobile homes on these mountains. This is a fact, and they won't deny this. They drop down mobile homes on these mountains. So the next morning when you wake up, a Palestinian living in the valley will see orange-roofed mobile homes, small little houses on their mountains. They will then move in Jewish settlers and declare that land to be a settlement. And over time, the government will heavily subsidize these things. And they'll grow into huge, beautiful neighborhoods. Efrat, which is one of the largest, has a population of 12,000 now. It's about a 20-minute drive east of Jerusalem. And they're all on the mountain ranges, so they're all strategically placed. And this is what Israel does. And they now have, I don't know if you can help me out, probably over 100,000 settlers now in the West Bank and Gaza, although I'm not sure.
I don't know what the figure is anymore.
It's an incredibly large amount for what they're doing. And they're spread all over the West Bank now and in Gaza. And these are colonies. I mean, there's really no other way to put it out unless you sincerely believe that Judea and Samaria, which is what Menachem Begin loved to call the West Bank, rightfully belongs to Israelis. Israelis like to say that it's their religious right to come back to the West Bank. But most Israelis will concede the fact that they want it militarily. This is not a God on their side type issue. They want it. They want it in wars, and they've been able to defend it successfully in succeeding wars. So that's what settlements are. So how do these settlements work? Well, they can't work isolated from each other. What the Israeli government has done since then is built beautiful roads between the settlements and into Jerusalem. And then they can go through Israel. These roads are not open to the Palestinians, and they go directly from settlement to settlement and then back into Israel. They bypass all of the roads. It was interesting, we were driving on one of these roads when we went to Efrat and some other places. Beautiful roads, not a crack in the concrete. And then you look down and we're going over a bridge, and underneath is a dirt road, and you see Palestinians either on their mopeds or, you know, donkeys and trailers riding on those. So there's very little development for the Palestinians, but these settlements are quite amazing with huge gates and sometimes walls around them. One of the most glaring examples of these settlements is the town of Hebron, which is where Abraham and Sarah are buried in the Abraham Mosque. Remember, in Palestinians who are Muslim believe that Abraham is their patriarch as well. This is also the mosque where the religious zealot went in and massacred 38 Muslims when they were praying at Ramadan, which is the holiest month of Islam. He went in there with a machine gun, and while they were praying, killed 38 of them and shot them in the back as they were bowing. Not the most noble way to do it, but he was actually tried to escape and was by a mob, he was torn to pieces. But now his tomb, which is in Kiryat Arba, which is one of the settlements in Hebron, is now visited by religious Jews as a shrine, as a holy shrine. Town of Hebron has about 170,000 Palestinians and 400 Jewish settlers. These 400 Jewish settlers are protected by 2,000 Israeli soldiers. What these 400 Jewish settlers do is they've taken over the downtown area. And under the protection of the Israelis, although they'll deny this, they walk around and they spray paint the Star of David on Palestinian businesses, cars, walls, everything. It's pretty blatant, and they walk around, and it was interesting, walking through the town, we saw a settler walking out of his synagogue, and he had the Torah in one hand, and in his back pocket he had his 9mm packed. And that's how they live, these Jewish settlers. They said that we are going to die here. This is where we will die. We brought our families here to die, not to live, to die. And this is their mission, is to take over this land. Those people generally do believe that this is their religious right. The rest of the Israelis don't really. They see this as a security. Israelis love to talk about security. So secular Jew versus religious Jew is the first conflict we'll talk about. Secular Jews, although they don't trust the Palestinians, and I don't think any Israeli really does, if you really press them or her on it, secular Jews are a little less inclined to talk religiously, of course. They're a little more open to dialogue with the Palestinians, and they're a little more genuine in trying to get peace. Religious Jews want peace as well. I mean, everybody wants peace, but they want it on their terms. And the Palestinian, in their view, will continue to live under Israeli occupation and control, and there will be no Palestinian state talked about, or any kind of Palestinian right talked about. So right now, Israel, some would say, is on the verge of a civil war between their Jews and not between Israeli Palestinians. There are Israeli Palestinians in Israel. That there is an incident outside of Tel Aviv, which is a very secular city. There's a secular neighborhood, and a Hasidic rabbi, brought his followers and his synagogue and moved into that neighborhood, bought a house, turned it into a synagogue, and started blaring religious music on the Sabbath, in an order to shoo people into their homes. Well, the secular Jews got together and had a dance party that night and blasted their dance music out. What ended up happening is there were firebombings of the synagogue, and firebombings of secular homes, of community, and a couple people died. And it got to the point where the government had to come and step in and say enough was enough. So the Jews are by no means unified. Then you have the Palestinians, and they are not unified at all. You have the old guard of Palestinians who follow Yasser Arafat, who's called the old man. The PLO is the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It's an umbrella organization. It's not one group, one nationalist group. It's a bunch of groups underneath Yasser Arafat. And they follow Yasser to an extent. The new generation are the desperate ones who've grown up in the refugee camps. There's about 3.5 million Palestinians living in refugee camps right now, or in exile. And they're the ones who've grown up and lived in these refugee camps where unemployment rate is about 70%, illiteracy rate is sky high, which is ironic because the Palestinians are the most educated Arab of the whole world in that area. Hamas, we've all heard about Hamas, which are the people who strap bombs to their bodies, walk onto a bus and blow themselves up. We've all heard about that. They're the ones who usually take credit for the terrorist acts, and they are terrorist acts which happen. What Americans don't know about is that Hamas is also the organization, and 99% of the people who belong to Hamas are also the people who do social security work for the Palestinians. They're the people who educate the Palestinian children when the Israel government closes down schools, and they do that quite regularly. Hamas is also the group that brings food and water, clean water, water that can be used for drinking and cooking. They're the people who build homes for the Palestinians. This is a wonderful organization. I mean, I think any Christian would say that. Then you have the military wing of the Hamas, which is the only part of Hamas that we hear about in America. So that's one conflict between the Palestinians, is the PLO, which is pretty entrenched as the authority, versus Hamas, which is more revolutionary, a little more militant, a lot more anti-Israeli and anti-Jew. Then, of course, you have Palestinian versus Jew, and then Jew versus Arab. Palestinians are Arab, they'll say that, but they're also Palestinian, they're Canaanites is what they say, which is one reason why they say that they have just as much of a claim to the land as the Jew does. The Canaanites were there just as long as the Jews were there. In fact, the Canaanites say that they were there before the Jew because they were conquered by Joshua. So you have Israel against Syria, for example. Syria's land, the Golan Heights, which is a fertile, beautiful land with mountains and fresh water running from its mountains in northern Israel, which was taken over in the 67 war. Syria won't negotiate on behalf of the Palestinians until they get the Golan Heights back. Netanyahu and the Israeli government before them has said, we're not going to negotiate the Golan Heights. This is fertile land, farmland, with fresh streams and water. And water is such a precious commodity in the Middle East. And then you have Arab and Palestinian. There was a kid on our trip, Amar Alshash, who was Syrian by heritage. He had been born and raised in the U.S., but his mother and father had lived in Syria all their lives. They don't like the Palestinians. Syrians and Palestinians don't like each other, nor do the Jordanians and the Palestinians, or the Saudi Arabians, or the Egyptians. Palestinians don't trust anyone, and why is that? Because they've been used as, Palestinians see themselves as being used as toys by the Arabs, as political leverage with the Israelis. They're not dealt with on an even keel. So there's a lot of distrust and enmity between the Palestinian and the Arab, and the other Arab countries. It's a really tragic situation for the Palestinians. They have really no one to turn to. Although it's interesting, I get to this a little later, which has happened yesterday in the UN. Maybe it's the first step for the Palestinians. So those are the conflicts, and so you can see how they kind of go on a multi-layered level. Everybody hates everybody else, and nobody likes each other. And they've all got an equal claim to this land that really isn't the most fertile land in the world. You would have thought that the Jews, if you want to speak for strictly practical reasons, would have been much better off in Uganda. It's fertile land down there, is what the Brits kept trying to say. What the Palestinians love to say is this is a colonial, that Israel is a colonial nation. It was built by an imperial power. And they statement they always say is, why didn't the English government, if they supported the creation of the State of Israel so much, why didn't they just build it in southern England? Why didn't they build it in southern France? If this is what they wanted, why didn't they build it there? Why did they have to go to a non-Western area that was inhabited by many, many people? And that's just the racism and the ethnocentricity that's involved in all of this.
Adam, don't you think there's also another kind of added under conflict, but there's certainly growing tension between the fact that in the same geographic area you have a very highly advanced first world nation, and then you have a third world nation that's getting poorer and poorer, and the economic gap between Israel and Palestinians is just getting worse by leaps and bounds.
That's so true. When we went to the West Bank, we went first to the settlement, Ephrat, and I have seen... I'm trying to think, are there people from Washington here? I mean, most people. I don't live in Washington, but I've visited it, and it was like Redmond, Washington, a middle-class American neighborhood. That's what it felt like. Beautiful homes, community centers, gymnasiums, running water, beautiful roads, parks. I mean, it was just gorgeous. I couldn't believe it. It was green, and the rest of the area is kind of brown. And then we went down the hill, and we went 5 minutes, and we got to the refugee camp of Arub. And there was open sewers. You could watch the sewage run down the street. Children without shoes, children who obviously hadn't bathed, because they can't bathe. The refugee camp is surrounded by 12-foot-high barbed wire, and you have Jewish, Israeli soldiers standing around with machine guns, and they harass the Palestinians. They don't allow them to leave unless they have everything in order. You have to have certain military checks and security clearances. And when we were walking around the camp, one of the kids came up to me and he pointed to the soldier and he said, "Yehu, Yehu," which is Jew. That's the only Jew he's ever known. He's about 8, 9, 10 years old. And the only Jew he's ever seen was the man with the big machine gun. That's the kind of people that are growing up in these refugee camps. And then you wonder why they strap bombs to themselves and blow themselves up. Because this is where they live. They don't call it home. The children who grow up in the refugee camps call Jaffa their home, even though they've never seen Jaffa. But it's that nostalgia that is kind of created within these camps. Their parents talk so romantically about the town of Jaffa, even though the parents left that town in 1947. They still talk about Jaffa as their home.
Adam, a colleague of mine has worked with the political elements of the Arab nations, and specifically the camps over there. And it's his contention that the leaders of the Arab do not want those camps to be taken care of, but they want them to be a festering sore so those kids can say, there's a Jew.
That's exactly what's going on.
Okay.
That's exactly what's going on, yes. That's to the Arab advantage, because then look what happens. I mean, the Palestinians are never able to solidify themselves and unify themselves, and the Arab countries are always kept in a dominant position over the Palestinians. And also, they don't want those camps to be stopped either, because then where do the Palestinians go? Well, they go to the Arab countries, and then Syria has to take them in. We actually did not even see the worst of the camps. The camps in the West Bank are probably the better of the camps. Camps in Syria and Lebanon are the really bad ones, because those are the ones neglected by UNRWA, which is the UN Refugee Work Association.
I'm really unclear about how the Palestinians are in the camps because they've been crowded out of.
The Israelis like to say that they're allowed to leave. They don't have to stay in the camps. They're not forced in the camps.
But if they leave camps, they have to go somewhere other than.
Well, they can't go into. They're not going to get into Israel. The Israelis have made sure of that. They've put closures on these camps, which means that you can't either leave the camp or you can't go into Israel, which is where most of the Palestinians work. They work in Israel, because there's certainly no work in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank. So there's this dependency by the Palestinians on this first world country of Israel.
Their homes, as well as their land, was confiscated in 48.
They have nowhere to go.
So they've been in camps.
Since
48.
Three
generations.
Yes. About three
generations ago. The little Gaza Strip down there, which I've forgotten the territorial size of it, but has more than a million people living in this postage stamp kind of thing. But they cannot leave unless they're married or past 30. Mm-hmm. There's no employment there, but to get employment, you have to be married or age 30 to get out. So the children never are able to get outside. Just, as Adam says, they only know the camp.
Just recently, 30 Palestinians were refused to go to Saudi Arabia to do their Hajj, which is the fifth pillar of Islam, which is where you go to Mecca and Medina to do your pilgrimage. They weren't allowed to leave, the Israeli government said, or I think it was almost 60, I think, actually, because of security clearances, because they're under the ages of 30. They weren't married. Maybe they had a previous record in the Intifada. And they just weren't allowed to practice their one of the five holiest things that their religion requires them, or not requires, but asks them to do.
So does the age 30 have to do with the average age of the terrorists?
Well, the terrorists are usually young men.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
so they're trying to screen them out.
Screen them out is what they say. It's interesting, if you go to Gaza, you have to walk a mile long. They call it a cow run, a cow shoot, yeah. Where you have to walk carrying your things if you're gonna go and you got clearance. You have to carry all your things on a mile long walk, and all the way along there are Israeli soldiers on high places watching you with guns. Yeah.
If I understood what I was hearing, it's in the political policy of both the Israelis and the large Arab nations that the Palestinians be kept in this position. From what you've seen and so on, is there any conceivable way out for those people?
No, there really isn't. And what's going on right now is they have been able to reclaim certain cities, Jericho, a part of Hebron was returned back to the Palestinian Authority. We'll get to that in just a second. But as far as a concrete government or some kind of institution that could control this, nothing of the sort. And part of that has to do with the Palestinians not being able to agree on their leader, although they were able to do that in the past under Yasser Arafat. But nowadays, Yasser Arafat is seen as a traitor by a lot of people because of the Oslo Accords. Another misconception in the American media, the Oslo Accords were greeted by the Palestinians with open arms, and that's not true at all. Mm-hmm. They saw it as a cop-out. Because if you notice in the Oslo Accords, nothing is ever put down in concrete. This much land will be returned in this much time. Nothing like that. There was all agreements on principles. And I think we can agree that principles kind of went out the window a long time ago in this.
You've certainly implied this, but stated clearly, one of the issues that we need to face as we sit here and talk about this ain't it awful situation is the involvement and support that the U.S. government has provided for it.
Yeah.
In the sense that Israel has become a first world nation by virtue of ours and others' support.
Yep.
And now, let me give you an example that just sort of overwhelmed Mary and me one day. We happened to spend 3 months there, a year and a half ago, I guess it was. But on a Sunday excursion that we were taking on one time, we went way out into the desert, down in the southern portion. And as we were coming, it was to see ruins of an ancient old monastery. As we were coming out, well, first of all, when we got there, there was this huge military oasis of trucks and equipment and tents and Israeli soldiers. And in our party was a man from France who worked with the French government in distribution of funds from France there. So he knew all of the political intrigue here. And as we left, this string of big trucks was hauling gravel in where they were making roads in the camp. And he turned to me and said, you recognize that's your U.S. aid, do you not? And I said, no, I don't. Tell me how. And he said, well, U.S. aid is channeled to private companies or individuals, which are then employed by the Israeli government. So that this is one of the ways in which it's kept quiet, that in effect, U.S. aid was building and supporting the military machine that conquered in 67, and which now is so powerful that overrun Palestinians in less than 6 days now, if they wanted to.
Yeah. The USA annually gives the State of Israel $3 billion. We give the entire world $12 billion in aid, one of the lowest, actually, per capita of government. We also give $2 billion in loans that are never expected to be repaid. So what we essentially give them is about $5 billion a year. Now, the Israeli government probably doesn't need that much anymore. It's been able to create itself, or we've created it to the point where it doesn't need to depend on us as much. But we give about $5 billion a year to the State of Israel, and about $3 billion to the State of Egypt, which has been involved in every single one of those wars. 1956 war, actually, who was the president at the time? It was Dwight D. Eisenhower who said, who allowed them to fight for a little while, and then he said, all right, you guys have to stop. And since he was supplying both countries with arms, they both stopped. It was not stopped by either of the countries, it was stopped by the president of the United States because he controlled what was going on at the time.
It was 56 war.
56 war, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 56 war.
Supposedly over the Suez Canal.
Yeah, supposedly over the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
There's always reasons given.
What do you know? What size the gross national product of Israel is now?
It's comparable.
What its military budget is?
It's comparable to Western European countries. The GNP. I don't know what its military the percentage of its budget is giving the military, but I would say it's an extremely high amount. The Israelis are so paranoid about security You should see the security checks they have. When you leave Tel Aviv from the airport, all 25 students of us were questioned individually for about an hour and a half about every single Palestinian we ever talked to, if we ever met any Palestinians, did we ever go into Palestinian homes. We went to a famous college in the West Bank, Beer Zeit, which is where the Israeli government always closes this college because this is where a lot of the political leaders come from. And when we said that we had been there, that opened up another can of worms.
I guess so.
It takes usually 8 to 9 years for a student to graduate from that college because they're either usually detained, imprisoned, or the college is closed by the Israeli government. So security is one of the big calling cards of the Israeli government. I'd like to say something about the Gaza Strip. This is an example of what's going on. The water from the Golan Heights, which I was talking about earlier, flows from the north, and it kind of flows southwest. And it should flow right into the Gaza Strip. That's not to say that this is it should be a fertile, promised land, you know, with beautiful farms, but it should be able to support a pretty large population. They have a population of over 1 million now. Right now, that area could support about 200,000 people. I mean, continually. What the Israeli government has done is either block that water off from the Gaza Strip and divert it into its southern farms, or what it has done is it's placed 20 pumps around the Gaza Strip. And these pumps pump whatever water there's left out and send that water into the settlements in Gaza Strip. The settlements in the Gaza Strip are internationally known for their wonderful oranges. I love oranges. I don't know how many oranges I've eaten that probably came from the Gaza Strip. It's interesting, there's a picture in National Geographic that showed a Jewish settlement in the Gaza Strip. And they're enclosed, circled, you know, encircled around itself, covered like a kind of like a covered wagon type feel. And it's beautiful in there, green everywhere. And then it stops. And it's barren sand and desert. And that's where the Palestinians live. I think there's about 4,000 settlers in the Gaza Strip. And they grow the best oranges, actually, in the world, is what it said. And so I get my Lutheran guilt kicking in and right about there. But, so that's kind of what the Israeli government does. They control the water, which is one of the biggest political commodities in the Middle East. And they can turn it on and off whenever they want, with pumps or with dams. So that's what's going on with the Palestinians. And then you wonder why they strap bombs on themselves.
And I'd like to attempt a hopeful response to the man that inquired, what could the Palestinians do, or what's possible hope for them? One is their historic ability and determination to manage for themselves, so that if out of all of this political process, they can obtain at least some land and some freedom to manage for themselves, whereby they can get out from under the oppression that the Israeli government puts on them. They will develop a society, it'll be third world, but they will manage for themselves in a way that perhaps another culture or ethnic group would not, simply because they don't have the experience. But as Adam has illustrated, whether it's with housing or water or the political process, they simply are not given a chance to do that at this particular point.
Sad. I want to talk a little about Yitzhak Rabin, who Americans saw as the savior of the peace process. I think is that a safe term? We all saw him as a pretty good guy who shook Arafat's hand, which is a pretty symbolic step, pretty big symbolic step. During the Intifada, which is when the uprising of the Palestinians in the late 80s, when young boys took to the streets throwing stones, and the Israelis returned with rubber bullets, which are nothing more than real bullets covered with a little thin coating of rubber, they still penetrate the body. They don't go as deep, boy in Ramallah, was it, was killed just a while ago by a rubber bullet right in between the head. The father of that boy donated the boy's organs to Palestinian and Israeli children. So, but these are young boys. We met one kid, or one man who was older than me by now, but he had a scar of his eye. He was shot by a rubber bullet when he was in the Intifada. Yitzhak Rabin was the man who came up with the term break their arms. And this was how he was going to solve the Intifada. Any man, any boy, or anyone caught throwing rocks or inciting riots during the Intifada would have his arm broken on the spot. And that was Yitzhak Rabin, our peace dove, in 1993, shaking hands with Arafat and Bill Clinton on the White House green. The Palestinians, it took them $1 million to get a picture of a Palestinian getting his arm broken. What they do is they put the arm like this, the butt of their gun, and break the arm right there. Somebody got a picture of that happening. And they tried to get it published in the Los Angeles Times. And it took them $1 million to get that ad put in. Whereas the regular price for an ad would be something like $25,000. That's what we have to deal with in America, is that it is a stereotype, and it's not, and you don't want to say it, but there's a large, and the Jewish lobby is very organized in America. You should look up your senator's, where he gets his money from, or her money from. Rudy Boschwitz in America, in Minnesota, I'm sorry, a Republican senator for Minnesota, was the third largest. I think he was getting a couple $1 million a year from the Jewish lobby. Whereas Paul Wellstone, who's also a Jew, but very sympathetic to the Palestinians, I think he's third to last. So they know where to put their money. They gave up on Paul Wellstone a long time ago. But, so that's Yitzhak Rabin, and that was his idea. And that's what was going on in the Intifada. I think we should leave on that, because I can't say anything more awkward than that. I'm just a same old kid.